Les colloques du Collège de France.
Pour cette première demi-après-midi, nous allons entendre Fadi Bardawil, qui est un chercheur invité dans le département of Near Eastern Studies et professeur associé visiting dans le département d'anthropologie de Princeton University. Il a avant cela été professeur de Global Studies, Contemporary Arab Cultures and French and Francophone Studies à Duke University. Il travaille sur l'articulation entre les productions culturelles et les pratiques politiques en mélangeant trois traditions intellectuelles, l'anthropologie politique, la théorie critique et l'histoire intellectuelle. Il est notamment l'auteur de Revolution and Disenchantment, Arab Marxism and the Binds of Emancipation, paru en 2020, une monographie issue de sa thèse qui examine la pensée marxiste et les pratiques dans les trajectoires des intellectuels, notamment nés autour des années 1940. Sa présentation s'intitule Reorienting Discourse, Foucauldian Traveling Theory, and the floor is yours.
Merci Magali, merci à Didier Fassin pour l'invitation et l'accueil chaleureux. Merci à Patrizia Foti pour tout ce qu'elle a fait pour nous, qu'on soit ensemble, et aux interprètes. Mon papier est en anglais. We are gathered today under the sign of Foucault Without Borders. And for one, Foucault's work crossed borders and at times crossed them fast, almost immediately, without the lag associated with the stages of reception, translation, publication, commentary. After publishing his first book in 1966, Edward Said spent a year as a visiting fellow at the Center for Advanced Study of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign in 1967-68. That same institution where about half a century later my co-panelist Behrouz Ghamari was going to write his own book on Foucault. Over there, Said worked his way through theoretical texts coming out of France at the time. He became known as a Foucault specialist. As Yoshiaki Mihara noted, a decade before the publication of Orientalism in 1978. Many years later, Said would boast in an interview with his good friend, Tom Mitchell, of being one of the first people to write about Les Mots et les Choses after it came out in France in 1966. Exciting as it could be, I will not, for the remainder of my talk, focus on the sociology of reception of Foucault's thought, a chapter in the American story of the so-called French theory, nor will I delve into an intellectual history of Foucauldian thought, of thinking of Foucault himself as a founder of discursivity alongside Marx and Freud. Rather, what I'm after is to think through a different act of border crossing, one which seeks to show and to think through how Foucault's concepts, but more importantly, his style of reasoning and his modes of investigation, were appropriated and put to use by two towering exilic Muslim and Arab intellectuals and critical theorists, Talal Asad and Edward Said. What I'm after then is underscoring the centrality of their engagement with Foucault's work as they were thinking their own projects and the existential, political, conceptual stakes surrounding them. In his first foray into a genealogical mode of investigation in the early 1980s, Talal Asad engages Foucault's Discipline and Punish, a book he admires both for its attention to power's minute workings to redefine truth, and I'm citing here, for raising doubts about triumphalist versions of rationality. While registering a minor disagreement with Foucault, he writes, "It is not enough, after all, to identify a practice as ritual. As Foucault," he adds, "that consummate ethnographer of Western culture knows full well." End of quote. A fleeting but truly arresting fragment that Asad does not gloss over. Foucault, that consummate ethnographer of Western culture. Remember, we are still in 1983. The West, the pastoral homestead of the universal, was yet to be looked at as being marked, as being a culture amongst others. It certainly had been grasped in civilizational terms, but as far as having a culture, it was critical reason and modernity that the rest of the world either lacked or had to catch up with. Ethnography was certainly not the disciplinary mode Western culture designed for its own self-examination. Philosophy certainly, sociology later coming to this and competing with it to dislodge it from its throne. True, Foucault still thought it adequate and scientifically valid during the great cycle of 20th century anti-colonial revolutions to narrate Europe's story as an internal, self-contained story. Or, as Edward Said put it in a very early critique in 1978, and here I quote, Foucault, he writes, does not seem interested in the fact that history is not a homogeneous French-speaking territory, but a complex interaction between uneven economies, societies, and ideologies, end of quote. But it's also true that Foucault's work, qua ethnography of Western culture, while staying in place in Europe, is its first act of border trouble. The genealogy, by rendering the familiar unfamiliar and loosening the naturalized grip of the present, render us, if not exactly strangers in our own homes, at least more skeptical in our dwelling. But who exactly is this us? For Foucauldian genealogies enabled a radical change of perspective by calling into question the authority of the triumphalist stories the West tells itself. But it did so as the West's own different modes of coercion, persuasion, and seduction addressed non-Western people, those on the southern shores of the colonial divide, to, as Sudipta Kavaraj put it, force their futures into versions of the Western past. So the history of the present that Foucault's genealogies was charting was supposed to be the future they develop into. This is one reason why Foucault's work and the works of thinkers drawing on it sometimes contain a high potential to flip valences from critique to ideology as they are read across the colonial divide. Orientalism, for one, and to Said's great dismay, was read by some in the Arab world less as a critique of the entanglements of Western knowledges with power than as an anti-Western, and here I quote Said, systemic defense of Islam and the Arabs, end of quote. Foucault's work also resonated with Assad's preoccupation with power and Assad's anti-theoreticist style of reasoning, partly indebted to Wittgenstein's investigations, which stood against the formulation of a general theory of anything, be it ideology or the symbolic. And for those of you who were here earlier at the last panel, you may recall the quotation that Bernard put on the wall where Foucault was saying, I'm not a theorist. And that's particularly part of the style of reasoning that Assad and Said were interested in. Throughout the 70s and 80s, Assad's essays expressed his misgivings about how functionalist, Marxist, symbolic, and Orientalist theories conceptualize the relationship between power, ideology, and practice. He showed, for instance, how Marxist anthropology reproduced functionalist assumptions, and how certain left analysis of Islam echoed both Orientalist and functionalist scholarship. Assad's genealogical investigations of imperial hegemony, in a manner parallel to Said's Foucauldian inflected work, as we will soon see, emerged precisely out of the misgivings with different schools of Western social theory. Let me give you an example from 1979. In a critical engagement with the work of Ernest Gellner on the concept of Baraka in Morocco, Assad notes that the author's account leave unexplained the authority of Berber religious ideology. For Baraka, Assad facts is not simply a concept which is with a constructed or disclosed meaning, but a part of authoritative Berber religious discourse. And it is no explanation of such discourse to say simply that people believe in it, and still less is it explained when we are told that in essence the concept represents a delusion." End of quote. He goes on to add in a footnote that Foucault observes, and here I quote, that religious delusion is a function of the secularization of culture. Religion may be the object of delusional belief insofar as the culture of a group no longer permits the assimilation of religious or mystical beliefs in the present context of experience. End of quote. As Assad was moving away from interpretivist approaches that sought to read meaning off from a cultural script, culture as text, and Marxist ones that viewed religion as ideology, a distortion or external justification for power, Foucault's rethinking of power became valuable. As Assad was rethinking it, and here I quote him, not simply as an external force, but as an internal relationship, a potentiality, the ability to do something. End of quote. Moreover, and here I go back to religion, by revealing the deep discursive transformations at work in Europe, Foucault's work enables the formulation of a different kind of reflexive critique of the social sciences across the colonial divide, not an ideological one that looks at them as instruments of colonialism, but one that folds disciplinary discourses back into the particular cultural terrain from which they emerged. And in that, doing that, it turns them from the ground of analysis to an object itself. Anthropologists, Assad writes, I quote, should learn to treat some of their own enlightenment assumptions as belonging to specific kinds of reasoning, albeit kinds of reasoning that have largely shaped in our modern world, and not as the ground from which all understanding of non-enlightenment traditions must begin. End of quote. As Assad's work moved from his early critique of colonial anthropology to an anthropological investigation of Western hegemony, we are brought back once again to his own early characterization of Foucault's work as an ethnography of Western culture, but with one important difference. This time around, by moving outside its borders, Assad's work is an investigation of imperial effects. For after all, it was him who described those on the other side of the colonial divide as conscripts of Western civilization. But empire in Assad's conceptualization, and here one can sense a debt to the Foucauldian divorce of the exercise of power from its possessors, is not the name of a well-defined actor, a subject with a conscious strategy, whose actions can be resisted by different actors. Rather, he understands empire as a subterranean, agentless, and I quote here, totality of forces that converge to create, largely contingently, a new moral landscape. End of quote. An upshot of this conceptualization of empire is a quiet exit from the analytical oppositional frame of power and resistance, repression and liberation, colonizer and colonized. An anthropology of Western imperial power, Assad writes, must try to understand the radically altered form and terrain of conflict inaugurated by it. New political languages, new powers, new social groups, new desires, new fears, new subjectivities. End of quote. Now, this stance stood in sharp contrast to the focus on interrogating essentialized representations of non-Western people in Western scholarship, media, and fiction that developed in the wake of Edward Said's Orientalism. Assad's accent was not on how the colonized is produced as a pathological other, a reified entity by colonial powers, think Fanon or Said, but rather on how imperial power restructures the conditions of experience and alters the terrain of practice. Discourses then are not equal when it comes to the strengths of their powers, to what they release into the world or disable in it. This is why Assad tracks transformation in legal reforms, administrative degrees, pedagogical manuals, for example, that enact and reconstruct conditions of those who have been conscripted by Western civilization. and rather than, for example, focusing on criticizing essentialized ethnographies or racist novels or another stereotypical depiction of Islam in the Western media. Given his subjectless view of empire qua West, Assad's genealogies of religion and the secular can be read as ventures to gnaw away the authority of the West, an aporetic speaking back without speaking back to the West. This time around, the effects genealogy produces are not attached to where it's read from, but with the locus of enunciation of the genealogist herself. I now move to the second part of the talk, which focuses on Edward Said. With Said, we move towards a conceptualization of imperial power, not as a force that radically refashions non-Western forms of life by erasing difference, but one that produces difference qua inferiority, to dehumanize, erect walls, and separate. For what is Orientalism in Said's articulation but a discourse that's premised on the epistemological and ontological separation between East and West, tied to a style of domination, a discursive apartheid of sorts? That said, what both Assad and Said's works share as they cross the colonial border, power in their conceptualization, whether erasing difference or fashioning it, loses its potential for reversibility that was conceptualized by Foucault. In Orientalism's introduction, Said writes, and I quote at length, "My own experiences of these matters are in part what made me write this book. The life of an Arab Palestinian in the West, particularly in America, is disheartening. There exists here an almost unanimous consensus that politically he does not exist, and when it is allowed that he does, it is either as a nuisance or an Oriental. The web of racism, cultural stereotypes, political imperialism, dehumanizing ideology, holding in the Arab or the Muslim is very strong indeed. And it is this web which every Palestinian has come to feel as his uniquely punishing destiny." End of quote. So the reading practice that set out to assemble a Western archive and subjected its discursive assumptions to critique for their entanglement with power is one, in my reading of Said, that ties the experience of racialization in the metropole with the colonial erasure of Palestinian existence at home. One which is, as a result, telescoped multiple pasts, such as current Western media discourses about Arabs, Zionist discourses about Palestinians, and even European medieval ones about Muslims. Let me flesh out. In his first piece on these themes, The Arab Portrait, published in 1970, Said registered an initial grief at the refusal to see Arabs as human beings. He writes, "During and after the June War, the 1967 June War between Israel and the Arab armies, few things could have been more depressing," he writes, "than the way in which Arabs were portrayed. What is most telling about Western consciousness of the Arab," Said writes, "is how few ordinary categories of human existence seem applicable to him." A page later, he makes an important connection by tying the negative value attached to the figure of the Arab with the fact that, and here I quote, "he is seen as the disruptor of Israel's continuing existence, or in a larger view, a surmountable obstacle to Israel's creation in 1948. This has been, of course, part of the Zionist attitude towards the Arab, especially in the years before 48 when Israel was being promulgated ideologically. Palestine was imagined as an empty desert waiting to burst into bloom, its inhabitants imagined as inconsequential nomads possessing no stable claim to the land and therefore no cultural permanence. At worst," he continues, "the Arab is conceived as a shadow that dogs the Jew. And that shadow, because Arab and Jew are both Semites, can be placed whatever traditional latent mistrust Americans might feel towards the Jew." End of quote. Registering racial grief in the wake of the misinterpretation of a Palestinian Arab in the US is mediated through circulating media images and political discourses about an Arab-Israeli war This is very different, for example, from the scene of intersubjective encounter with the racializing gaze of the child on a train that Fanon examines in Black Skin, White Masks. What is crucial for us, though, is that this moment is experienced through a telescoping of times and spaces which connect home and exile, past and present, Israel and the US. A few years later, in the context of another Arab-Israeli war, the October War of 1973, Said revisits and develops the same themes. He writes, "For the Palestinian, perforce, his national identity is an embattled resistance to dispossession and extinction. Yet, for most of the world, he has seemed like cigarette ash, moved from corner to corner, threatened always with irreversible dispersion." End of quote. Palestinian double consciousness and second sight. It's very hard to resist framing these works through W.E. Du Bois's question, how does it feel to be a problem? The insurrectionary critical spark of this integrative critique Said carried out resonated far beyond the specialized scholarly debates of Orientalists. Said's Knowledge Power trilogy, and here I'm not only thinking of Orientalism, but of Orientalism 1978, The Question of Palestine 1979, and Covering Islam 1981, is in one respect the result of a formidable expenditure of critical non-disciplinary energy, which in the span of a few years strove to compile an inventory of traces to reckon with the Oriental subject's historical racial schema, to quote Fanon one more time, a schema produced from elements put together, as Fanon said, by the other, the white man, who had woven me out of a thousand details, anecdotes, story, and which Said can no longer escape in the wake of his wartime racialization. Now, what does all of this have to do with Foucault? Well, Foucault's notion of discourse is what enabled Said, so to speak, to take stock of the telescoping of times and spaces, to reveal the coherence and systematicity of what may seem like haphazard occurrences by revealing a discursive ground of communality amongst conflicting theoretical positions, opposed political ideologies, and varying registers of cultural production. Let me flesh it out further. The Arab-Palestinian impasse, for instance, cannot be accounted for on the grounds of ideological distinctions between left and right. Neither solidarity with the Palestinians in the metropole, nor Israeli politics itself, can be accounted for on that axis. In fact, a significant number of Zionist settlers were ideologically on the left, and some were Marxists. In addition to rendering ideological distinctions epiphenomenal, Foucault's notion of discourse moves beyond anchoring analysis in culturalist distinctions and, more importantly, historicist and sociological ones. A frequent problem with the sociology of knowledge, Said writes in Beginnings 1975, which constitutes the methodological backbone of the later trilogy, has been a narrowly circumscribed Western industrialized social paradigm. Anything beyond that setting, the industrialized social paradigm, seems to resist the method. Foucault's criteria, he continued, have a tighter internal discipline and a wider general sweep than that. Moreover, he continues, Foucault's theories are designed to illuminate a large number of repetitive phenomena that are continuously appearing with such disconcerting randomness as to seem chaotic. End of quote. Which is exactly what he'll put to work in the trilogy by bringing together works of high erudition with Victorian pornographic novels, high-end popular culture, novelists with experts, fiction and non-fictions, politicians with scholars, practice and thought, colonialists and revolutionaries, right and left. What Said is attracted to in Foucault's method is that it neither functions like, and here I quote, like a pass key for unlocking texts, again, the sort of anti-theoretist style of Foucault, nor works by compiling a large number of different individual details into a smaller set of general principles. And more importantly, perhaps, does not equate the critical gesture with unmasking ideological tenets and uncovering the logic of misrecognition at work, which is masquerading particular interests as universal ones. It is clear, Said writes, that my concern with authority, the authority of Orientalist discourses, that is, does not entail analysis of what lies hidden in the Orientalist text, but an analysis rather of the text's surface, its exteriority to what it describes, Orientalism, end of quote. It is this method which enables us to bring the racism, colonialism, imperialism nexus into a single analytical frame through offering a particular decoupage which reveals the coherence, systemicity, and authority of discursive occurrences regarding the Oriental. Constituting an alternative to predominant interpretive frameworks derived from classical Western social theory that either take the ideological, the social, or the historical as the ground of analysis of cultural production. More importantly, the stakes around developing that alternative methods are crucial, for such theories, including progressive ones, can be marshaled to justify the elimination of the native. In a commentary on the essay, A View of Palestine, written by the Christian theologian Reinhold Niebuhr, Said notes that Niebuhr's real intention is, and here I quote Said, nothing more than saying that whether they have an opinion or not, Arabs ought not to be allowed to obstruct the technical and dynamic civilization being brought into Palestine by the Jews. End of quote. This is from Question of Palestine, 1979. He goes on to add what he, i.e. Niebuhr, does not see, as Marx did not see 100 years earlier when he wrote about the British in India, is that there was a national right being violated even by, he quotes again Niebuhr, a technical and dynamic civilization when it made colonial incursions upon the miserable masses, end of quote. Now, Said's engagement with Marx and Niebuhr, from my reading, is a very early calling into question of the multiple discursive logics of justification for eliminations of Palestinian natives. It is an indigenous critique, certainly not grounded in any indigenous cosmology, but enunciated from its locus. Colonization, Said was saying, is not part of a dialectical process of progress. It cannot be redeemed through the developmentalist logic that sees it as the unconscious tool of history that's destroying the old to bring forth the new, which will ultimately convert violence into justice. Rather, what it establishes instead is a colonial relation. This is one way through which we can apprehend Said's condensation of the struggle between Palestinians and Zionism, as he put it, and here I quote him again, as a struggle between a presence and an interpretation, the former constantly appearing to be overpowered and eradicated by the latter. What was this presence, Said adds? No matter how backward, uncivilized, and silent they were, the Palestinian Arabs were on the land, end of quote. Foucault, Said writes, seems unaware of the extent to which the ideas of discourse and discipline, and here I quote at length, are assertively European, and how along with the use of discipline to employ masses of detail and human beings, discipline was also used to administer, study, reconstruct, and then subsequently to occupy, rule, and exploit almost the whole of the non-European world. This dimension, Said adds, is wholly absent from Foucault's work, even though his work helps one to understand it, since it strikes me as being a definitive part of modern history. Some account of this European hegemony over the world needs to be taken, end of quote. Of course, Said was far from a straightforward Foucauldian. After all, he emphasized continuity within discontinuity in his compilation of the Orientalist Archive, unlike Foucault's reconfiguring breaks. He also resisted drowning an author's singular voice in an anonymous sea of discourse, a position which cannot be disentangled from his humanism and his firm political conviction in the critical vocation of the intellectual and his heroic role, not only in oppositionally speaking truth to power, but also in providing alternatives to injustice. He also underscored in 1978, very early on, what he dubbed Foucault's flawed attitude to power, noting, and here I quote him one more time, that it's the most dangerous consequence of his disagreement with Marxism, and its result is the least convincing aspect of his work. End of quote. In short, Said adds, power cannot be made analogous to a spider's web without the spider, nor to a smoothly functioning flow diagram. A great deal of power remains in such coarse items as relations of production, wealth, and privilege, monopolies of coercion, and the central state apparatus, end of quote. This is from the same year as Orientalism was published. I would like to end by going back to Said's beginnings. There, he comments on the passage from the famous interview on intellectuals and power between Foucault and Gilles Deleuze in 1972. He writes, an active, not to say aggressive, sense of writing underpins this passage. For, prendre la parole, in French in the text, usually means to begin to speak, to take the floor, to occupy the foreground, to make explicit what is usually allowed to remain implicit, to state that which, because of professional consensus, is ordinarily not stated or questioned, to begin again rather than to take up writing dutifully at a designated point and in a way ordained by tradition. Above all, to write in and as an act of discovery rather than out of respectful obedience to establish truth, between quotation marks. These add up to the production of knowledge. They summarize the method of beginning about which this book turns. End of quote. I could not find a better way to bring my talk to a close. For what is Said's trilogy but an act of prendre la parole by a Palestinian Arab to resist erasure at home and contest racialization in exile? An act constituted in part by thinking with, against, and through the work of Michel Foucault. Thank you.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.